Welcome to the Virtual Velo Podcast, episode 34. I am your co-host, joint host, Chris Cybradley. I'm Cybradley, you're Chris Schwenker. How are we doing, Chris?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm pretty sure I'm Chris Schwenker, and I would say that I'm your co-host, absolutely. Episode 40, is this a milestone? Like, when I turned 40, I had, like, a big party. In fact, my wife invited George Hincapie, and he showed up, believe it or not. I don't know if I showed you those pictures when we were together, but it was amazing. He actually rode with us the next day. He came on a ride with me and my buddies after the party the night before. And as we were riding along, he comes up beside me and he goes, "Chris, your friends ride really fast." And I'm thinking to myself, how much did my wife have to pay him to say that?
Well, no comment. Well, I tell you what, you gave me some grief on the last podcast, and because Emma, my wife, took a listen last week. She said, "Well, I can't believe you mentioned that you're good at getting married because you've done it a couple of times." And I'm gonna come back on you now because you've definitely told me that story before, and I think you've told me in one of these shows before as well. You haven't told me that last bit, but you've definitely told me that you had George Hincapie at your birthday before. So I'm not sure what's happening with you. You're forgetting what you've told me, Chris. That's what I'm saying. But let's move on. Go on.
I tell every single person that I come along that story, whether they know anything about cycling or not, and I try to tell them as many times as I can.
Well, we've got to go on because there's so much to get through today. I mean, first of all, Chris, today is going to be an interesting, contentious show, but I'm going to get onto that. But yeah, we're going to come on to that because we've got an ex-employee of Zwift coming onto the show. But let's cover that in a bit more detail. I just want to firstly go through what we're going to be talking to later in the show after we've spoke to our guest, should I say. There's so much news happening right at the moment, Chris, and I guess it's because we've got the lead-in, or we've started the lead-in already, to the UCI World Championships for Cycling Esports, which, of course, are taking place in October. So there's a lot we've got to talk about after we've had our guest in, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, people look at the schedule and they say, you know, the finals is not until October. So this is creeping up on us fast. And, you know, the public qualification pathway is going to be in just a couple months. I think the federations have a very short time to select their teams.
Yeah, well, that's something, of course, we're going to talk about because there's been some fantastic events, some live national championship finals that we've seen in Denmark and Sweden, saw the Aussie finals as well. But you're right. I mean, those, I think from what I read in your article, those public qualifications are going to happen in May, June. So I guess any outstanding qualification that the federations are going to do, you know, and you and I have spoke to British Cycling recently as well. It was still pretty unclear what's happening with those guys. So there's not much time here for these guys to get their act together. So we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail. We're going to talk about some of the technical difficulties that we saw at some of those finals. We're going to talk about the Zwift Games, of course, because that's happened. And there were some really interesting viewer numbers for those, which I think is really useful. Interesting little tidbit there as well. I know we've got this April Fool's VR headset. I know you've got some thoughts on that, Chris. So we're going to visit that at the end of the show as well. But let's talk about today's guest, because today's guest, we have got Flint McInnes in there, Chris, in the show. Now, you and I have tried to get Flint on this show before, of course, but it's unfortunate that he's in the position he's in because, of course, he's an ex-employee Zwift, but it's fortunate that we can get him on the show.
You know, I know that the way this is going to look to people, you know, we tracked down this disgruntled ex-Zwift employee to tell us all the deep, dark secrets about the company. It's hard to deny. If that's what you want to think, you can certainly think that. But the truth of the matter is that we've been trying to get Flint on the show since last September, when I heard him speak during the this season on Zwift, the press conference, right?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And I brought you in on that, and you listened to him, and you said to me, we need to get Flint on because he's so passionate, he's so sincere, he's so knowledgeable. Since then, we've been asking and asking and asking to get a member of the competition team, and we haven't been able to. It's frustrating, and it's a real shame that this is the way that we have to go about this.
It's an interesting one for me, Chris, because I think what I see is that Zwift's control the narrative. From what I can see, I think they're very good at utilizing and selecting those podcasters, those paid affiliates who've got blogs and different YouTube channels and so on to really control that narrative. And I'd say it's unfortunate because, let's face it, you know, I flew halfway around the world to meet up with you to try and get in front of these guys, and it wasn't a shut door right at the start. You know, we said, yeah, we should be able to get in front of somebody. and then it just didn't happen in the end. You know, I know there was board meetings and so on going there at Zwift, but it's unfortunate. However, coming on to Flint, you know, of course, yes, you and I have heard him speak, and he's a very passionate, you know, engaging and an informed individual. But he also, just thinking about the community, he's also the one in the community who is more public-facing, because he was quite often in those forums as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another one of the reasons why we wanted to speak with him. And he's also, from what I've heard, is extremely knowledgeable about the product. And like that's the thing that's, you know, so I don't know, it's a challenge for us to get this information. It forces us to be creative, right? We've found this gentleman that's going to be able to give us a little bit of information that we've been trying to get. It also forces us to do our homework, because in order to bring the audience the level of information and informed opinions that we want to bring, we have to work harder. I was obviously a physical therapist for, I guess, 25 years, and I was self-employed for 24 of those years. My practice was one of many in the town that I was in, and a lot of them were owned by physicians, and physicians would refer themselves to their own patients. I didn't have that luxury, so I had to work harder in order to get patients and have a successful practice. I almost feel like it's the same way for people in independent media. You actually have to work harder in order to get the accurate stories, to get the accurate information, to have an informed opinion. You know, it takes a lot of preparation and a lot of work in order to be able to bring that.
Yeah, well, I have to say that's all on you, Chris. I just read your articles, and we discuss it, of course, as often as we can. But I know you're the man with a finger on the pulse, and I'm forever impressed with the contacts. You know, one of the things we've got to talk about as well is Michael Rogers, of course, leaving the UCI. And I know that you've already had, you know, a discussion with him post him leaving the UCI as well, is, you know, because you speak to these individuals and you're constantly chasing these stories and speaking to people in the know. So that is really appreciated. But I just want to echo what you said at the start as well. This isn't about having an ex-Swift disgruntled employee. I've got no idea what Flint's, you know, coming on to say, or, you know, we're going to discuss. We've got an idea. But as far as I was concerned, I wanted to speak to Flint originally because he was looking after the Zwift Racing School. You know, and therefore he was looking more on the cycling esports side. So I'm really interested to find out where that project was at when he left, what's happening moving forward. So I think let's not beat around the bush. Let's get Flint in and we can ask a few questions, get going and see where we are. All right. Well, it is my pleasure to welcome Flint McInnes to the show. Flint, welcome to, you won't know this, Flint, but we made a request to get you on or just talk to you months ago when you were at Zwift, because of course we went on Chris went on the press conference, which was this season in Zwift, if I remember,
sure,
with Mark Cote, Chris, if I remember rightly. And we saw you doing a presentation on, I think, on Zwift Racing School and other things. And I immediately said to Chris when I'd seen you present, we've got to get Flint in on the show if we can. So firstly, look, sorry that you've been cut with Zwift, as it were, and you're in the situation you're in. So, how's it been this last couple of weeks?
It's been okay. Thanks for having me, for wanting to listen to whatever I have to say. That's always flattering, you know, when people want to hear what you have to talk about. For whatever reason, I'm not going to speculate too much further, so I'm happy to be here and chat your guys' ear off. I've been doing okay. You know, it's been a couple of months. No bitterness to my heart. You know, there's always those like five stages of grief and whatever, like, oh man, this sucks, what have you, but I'm doing all right, I think. I get some time to focus on what I want to do, get some skiing in before the season ends, and, you know, figure out like what it is that makes me tick in an employment sense, which I think is always a fun thing to do. So not bad. Thanks for asking.
Well, we were happy to have you. And as a member of the competition team that was, you know, doing some big work, you know, the Zwift Racing School was, really meant to be, you know, a big thing for the company. I just want to make sure that we're, you know, everyone's clear that these are just purely your opinions, right? You're just telling the experience that you had. We mentioned during the intro that, you know, people are going to look at this like, oh, we pulled a disgruntled Zwift employee in here. Yeah, wow. We've had pre-production and we discussed it. And, you know, it's just another way to get a little bit of insight into, you know, esports and the evolution and, you know, where we're going to go in the future.
No, I was just going to say, why don't you just give us a bit of background? What was your title and what was your, how did you start with Zwift and where did you end? Where was the role when you ended there?
As usual, the journey was kind of circuitous and a little odd and unpredicted. So at the ending of it, right when you get the email, it's like, hey, thanks for your service. See you later. I was just a product manager. I threw bilingual in there because I learned French a few years ago, and that's what I originally was hired for. So I got hired in 2019 in August after living in Bordeaux for the better part of a year and finishing out my degree at a late, like, 28. And I needed a job, so I got hired as a customer service representative at Zwipe to just answer people's emails. And the way it was structured was I was kind of the last bastion of support for people, right? So they would go through a vendor similar to whoever, and then, like, if the problem was too hard, I would be the person to kind of help provide information. And I was supposed to be doing that for the French-speaking people. I think I probably confused them more than not. But then that job, you know, quickly turned into just technical specialty and things like that. And then when Zwift purchased Zwift Power in, like, what, 2020-ish, like, officially, I got my start into product management simply for the fact that I was really tired of answering emails about Zwift Power, because I was the only person at the time who had, like, racing information on the support staff. So it would all get directed to me. So I was like, oh, we need documentation. And then, somebody said to me, very generously, hey, you're doing, like, a baby version of a product management job. Do you want to try this out for sure? And I said, yeah, like, why not? And then my knowledge of bike racing and Zwift and bike parts and computers and everything else kind of came in this confluence. And I worked my way from that position with the help of a lot of people, I should say, not, like, of my own merit entirely. I worked my way up through that to become the product manager for the competition team at the head of a very capable team, co-leading it with my coworker, Ryan, who is the engineering manager. And those guys were great. I loved working with everybody over there. So that's how it ended versus how it started.
So you were also the forums guy too, right? You're the guy who everyone thought was, like, an AI bot responding to the forum issues over there.
And that was by choice. I have a long history just playing MMOs and other video games in general, right? Like, that's how I spent a lot of high school, was in Warcraft doing, like, high-end raiding and really kind of, I've always been a competitive person in that way, but I always admired when people from companies would give you, like, a cheeky response, or they would acknowledge you, and it felt very human. And I've kind of always valued that, right? The human element to everything. And I believed, especially with the folks who are heavily invested into racing on Zwift, that it was important to provide them with as much context as I could, because I was recognizing that there wasn't always a lot of communication from Zwift, period. Right. And that's no fault of anybody's. Like, when you're at the head of that, like, large orange ship, it's hard to kind of say things that aren't going to get taken out of context. And so whatever reticence or hesitancy, or, like, I'm not worried about that, but I took it on myself to be the forums person, because I felt like it was my responsibility in that job of a product manager to let people know what we were doing, because it was also some of the more technical stuff, right? Like, when it comes to competition, like, either in game or in real life, there's a lot of, like, numbers and stuff like that. So I wanted to try to give people information. It didn't always land well. And I think I even had, like, a breakdown post on there once or twice. It was like, just leave me alone. But yeah, I was a forums guy. And that was totally my own volition. Nobody asked me to do that.
So speaking of forums, you know, as we were preparing for the show, I came across a forum post. So I'm just going to read you what the poster said and then what someone commented. And I want to get your impression of this.
Okay. Right.
So there's, you know, this was after, actually, it was probably only a week ago. Someone said, what a shame Flint is gone. I would like to think that the work he was driving wouldn't get completely canned, but the signs aren't great. And then someone commented, is it negative that he's canned? I mean, multiple players driving the ZRS should be canned. The time it took them to get project moving compared to the Zwift racing app is a joke. The Zwift racing app is done by one person, while the Zwift racing score was done by a team. Now, I would think that type of dialogue must have driven you crazy while you were working for the company, right?
Is it a fair
comment? You know, is it?
Yes, right. But it doesn't drive me crazy, because I learned a lot in the forum. The first thing was, originally, I was always trying to prove that I, like, had the answer. And I definitely took it upon myself to try to, like, show people that I knew what was up. And that's, like, a personal thing. I'm a very prideful person, and I always wanted to kind of demonstrate that, like, I was the person for the job, and some of that's through insecurity, whatever, right? But that's, like, the beauty of maturation and wisdom. And then later on, they were irritating, but not because I was holding it against anybody and, like, oh my god, this person is so awful and whatever. It was more like I felt it was a failure to clearly communicate enough context or deliver to people, like, the right type of messaging, mostly on my behalf, to, like, not make them trust me, but at least show them like we're going in the direction and this isn't just a bunch of lip service, because I'm cognizant of the fact that like if you're with the company, everything I say to you is going to be, sorry, if I'm the guy with the company, everything I say to you as the customer or the consumer is going to feel like I'm trying to get you to buy what I want. And that could be information, that could be my product, whatever. And I definitely took that stance originally. But then I realized, like, I think I'm just not doing a good enough job communicating. And I was also sometimes, you know, not able to say everything that I wanted to. I'm much more like a guy that goes for transparency than anything. So it's irritating not to say like those people upset me, but it's irritating because I didn't feel like I always could give them enough information to hopefully like at least let them know I was like on the right track or doing what I hoped was right. That's kind of it. If that makes sense, like I feel like maybe I lost the plot for a second, but yeah, no ill will to anybody on the forum. They're a bunch of passionate folks, man, and video games are no different. Like we get upset at the things we care about the most, like parents to children, you know, lovers to lovers, like consumers of a product they've been around in since beta, like whatever, right? Like they're not all the same level of gravity, but you're critical because you care, and I'm more critical of myself than probably any of those people because I have all the information and it's frustrating. So yeah, no derision, you know, but yeah, it's irritating, but not for the reason that you might be thinking.
I think forums are a really interesting place to deep dive sometimes because you're right. Sure. You know, it's where the passionate people, whether yep. they're right or wrong, whether it's positive or negative, that's where you go to vent or discuss and share and so on. However, if just looking at that post there, the focus is on that Zwift Racing score. And yep. obviously, you know, when you presented to us, you know, that was what you were talking about, and that was going to be yep. coming, you know, in this season in Zwift. So, you know, how close is or was, you know, the Zwift Racing score to completion?
So Chris Nook, if you're listening, I'm going to do my best to try to embody you as much as I can. But, you know, as former player, I'm not going to spill any secrets in terms of like all the numbers and stuff. But I think the thing that really gutted me the most about getting the Monday morning email of like, hey, thanks, you're out, was that like we were probably 95% of the way finished with that. In terms of like we had everything set up, and I can kind of talk about some of it because a little bit got out, right? Like there was a release recently on the web where we had like, not we, sorry, Zwift had like new race results, and there was like some racing score information that slipped, right? So the thing that made the project really hard and where the comparisons to Tim's site are logical but not necessarily applicable all the time, this is Zwift Racing app, Tim Hansen, I think what he's yep. doing is great. Like I've talked to him. He's a great dude. I'm in his Discord. I listen to what people have to say. I still read it after the fact just because I think it's interesting, right? And you guys are here, right? We kind of all have that common love of like, yep. like what's going on. But mm-hmm. the difference was, or I should say the frustrating thing potentially on the community's behalf, my guess is that the reason the comments like that, like, oh, I'm glad he's gone, you know, like Cannonball, there's a lot more to change, right? Like Zwift, the problem that I was always facing in that role, especially with a project like Racing Score, was we all knew that it was going to be a fundamental change to the very, very core systems of Zwift, right? Like watts per kilo, ABCDE categories have been around since the dawn of that program. And we were proposing to do something different. You cannot make those decisions lightly, rashly, nor quickly, and that also can breed, you know, some waffling and this and that, of course, which I was guilty of myself. But really the hard part with that project was, if you look at like what Tim is doing on Zwift Racing app, yes, you can build a system, and I'm not saying like anybody can just go buy it off the shelf, right? Like, but you can make a system for ranking and it can work really well. For Zwift, in like the official capacity, we had to think about like, okay, how do we educate people who have never raced, how do we get them to understand what it is? How do we make it feel not necessarily punitive, but encouraging? Because that was the whole reason for it was, on one hand, we wanted to get more people competing like on the platform because it's really fun, right? Like the people that race on Zwift have a great time and they mostly exclusively race or train to race or something. And we believe that people could do that, but the experience was so crappy that we had to kind of make it better. And one of the big problems was watts per kilo for a whole bunch of reasons that like could take more than the 30 minutes we have here to talk about. But that aside, we also had to deal with UI, user experience, information, you know, understanding, getting people to change the system. And so I understand the frustration of like, why couldn't they just have done it? The part that was hard for me to swallow is not comments like that, but as I said, we were so close and I had it all planned out and I had been working with people through December and January and like, here's our test date and our work back and we're going to communicate it this way and this is when it's going to happen and this is how we're doing it and these are the holes that exist. And I had all this stuff prepped. It wasn't going to be perfect by any means, but it was really, really close to getting out the door. I don't know where it stands now. I hope that it still is. We'll see. So that's a bit of kind of like behind the curtain, but it was, oh man, it was right there, you know?
So what you were talking about there really was more relating to the experience and the users and the onboarding and so on and making it understandable. So, but I didn't hear anything about the infrastructure, the build, you know, the build of the game, the build of the platform and so on. Was that restricted in any way, or was it about the experience? I'm just trying to figure out, of the way I look at Zwift at the moment, it's about getting non-racers on, you know, the softer audience, which is what I've heard from them before. So is it that Zwift Racing School would complicate that too much, or was it an infrastructure thing, or is it a combination of the two?
It's those two things, and I think it's one other thing, right? So there's kind of this like weird triangle or Venn diagram or whatever visual image you want to conjure for yourself. So on the one hand, it's technical, and that's not to like drag the technical architecture and infrastructure of Zwift. Like every game ever, like, and I have a lot of friends that work in video games, and Seattle, where I live, is very tech heavy, so you kind of get all this information. But you know, people come from other studios. Every game has its problems, and all it is a facade, and you're just trying to be like sold to as the end consumer of it, right? So Zwift, everybody kind of like the easy track to take, and some of it is justified, some of it is not, is like, oh, it's just this old garbage, you know, code, and it should be totally scrapped. Sometimes yeah, sometimes not. So there's that. There's the introduction, as you were mentioning, Simon. So it's like, yeah, we got to get more people on. We got to have people who aren't as familiar with cycling try to understand this thing. Hence, you know, why we look to something like Zwift Racing App to emulate, where it was like going to be, you know, this number on the scale, and all those things were arbitrary. But it was like, let's get away from watts per kilo, because those are very mystic and people, you know, have opinions, whatever. And then the third was, it still needs to be credible for all the vets and all the hardcore folks that are there. You know, and that's what we were really trying to nail. And I knew it was going to be like, if all things had continued in a perfect world, we're talking maybe 2 to 3 years before it's like really, really good. I was resigned to that fact, like, but I wanted to get something out the door. The architectural problem is what I think constituted the biggest amount of time that it took. And some insight into that is basically like, without like revealing too much, just for the sake of like, I don't want lawyers coming after me, but... I also want to be very specific. We had to build a whole lot of new stuff to support Racing Score that never existed in Zwift, while also trying to undo certain knots to pull necessary information out. So there was a lot of like, basically demolition, moving, addition, remodeling, and brand new construction happening all at once. And that was across user experience, internal stuff, backend services, all that, right? So there's a whole lot of stuff that it cascaded into, but that is a whole other conversation that could take forever. So yeah, anyway, it was a bit architectural than the other two things that I mentioned.
Yeah, so I'm hearing you say that racing wasn't built into the DNA of Zwift. And I would contend that there might be a fourth and a fifth factor to your Venn diagram, visual, or however you're putting it.
Yeah.
There's the executive team.
Yeah.
Right. And there's also the investors.
Yeah. And that's always a factor, you know, and that's always a factor. You see that in video games today, like, players want X, investors want Y. Investors want money, period. No ill will towards those guys, but it doesn't always jive with what players, consumers, you know, participants, users want. And there is some concession to be made for that too. So yeah, you're on the mends for that for sure.
So then the next question is, you know, the fourth and fifth factors, what did they feel about racing? Were they committed to competition on the platform?
From everything I was told, yeah, right? Like, there's a lot of speculation that can be done, and I'm not here to speculate. I want to just kind of, again, have this larger discussion, right? But the way that I, on the one hand, if you want to be very cynical, the way that I justified my paycheck was because racing had legs to stand on. On the other hand, you know, the numbers supported that, right? And either way, it came down to this data. What we found that was really interesting, which I was kind of first skeptical of, but then started to realize was fairly true, was that like the folks that are on Zwift to race and that race like more than twice a month, like on average. It could be like three in a month and one, or, you know, just whatever. Just talking average monthly race is like two or more. Those people are there more than anybody. And I was speaking with Sean Perry, Johnny Noblett, and the three of us, like, we kind of had this idea that, like, so Chris, what you said, competition wasn't built into Zwift's DNA. I think yes, but also no. I think yes, because it wasn't like a feature set that was, you know, or that was in mind when Zwift was being built, right? Like John Mayfield, I think, wanted a more fun way originally to just not be bored on the trainer, which like we kind of all look for, hence the Sufferfest and all that other stuff prior to Zwift. I mean, even CompuTrainer, right? But then I think it is built into Zwift's DNA because I don't believe personally that cycling is not a competitive sport. I just think the way that the competition shows itself is different for everybody. And I think Zwift was always competitive just to different levels. By that, I mean, at the very like explicit, obvious end, you have racing and competition, which is, yes, competition by name and definition and practice. Then you have things like segment leaderboards. And then you have things like, you know, even the Zwift Big Spin recently, where it's like you're kind of competing with yourself to see like how much you can ride. And then the Everest Challenge and like everything, right? But it always comes back to this level of competition. And training is even that way, right? Like last week I did X number of watts for this many minutes. This week I need to do X plus percent watts for this many minutes. So we were trying to kind of get everybody to that, not only because the data suggested they would be there more than everybody, which for the business is good. And that's kind of, again, how I justified like my existence on a payroll, but because I think that's sort of what it all boiled down to, is everybody kind of eventually landed there to some extent. And we had seen that like a lot of people try racing, they just bounce off it because it sucked. Right. So that's where we were anyway.
Yeah. I think I'm hearing what you're saying, but I probably would look at it in a different way. When you're talking about leaderboards, okay, when you're talking about the Big Spin, that's motivation. That's not competition to me, right? Competition is, you know, purpose built for racing stuff. Is it possible for the platform to cater to both the soft fitness Peloton market and also the hardcore racing market if it doesn't have that built into the DNA?
I see what you're saying. I think from that standpoint, say the answer is yes, but not at the same time. Again, just like my personal feeling. I think the one thing that I've always, like, if I compare Zwift to just other video games in general, right? Like, this is going to come up a lot because I have a lot of experience there, but I think it is this nice confluence of both, right? So you're going to get cycling, you're going to get games, whatever. The games or the activities or the sports or whatever that I think do the best are the ones that decide what they are and then stick to that. And the ones that flounder are the ones that try to do too much. And Zwift at times I definitely felt was trying to do too much. I don't think their direction to go for, in your words, like the Peloton audience, or in a more marketing term, like the softer audience, which is, you know, people who don't cycle very often or have like a lower FTP or whatever you want to use that. Like, I don't care what the definition is, but softer for just this catch-all term. Like, you can end up getting those people to compete, which is great. Just, I was, and I always said this internally, to people like Sean, to people like Johnny, even to John Mayfield, just choose what you want to do. You know, like, I don't feel so hellbent on competition as a person that I need to have Zwift be the competitive platform. The other thing that really got me stoked about Zwift was all the stuff that was, as you said, Chris, motivational. Let's make it more gaming. Let's make it more fun, because those things are cool. Give me a reason to want to get on the platform, which is, I think, why we all started it in the first place, right? When I first got hired, I was so excited. I did the ZA for 2019, like halfway through the month, but I was so pumped to like level up, get these things, do this. It was like, it was really engaging because it was something I knew from other games. I wish we could also have done more of that, right? I felt like Racing Score was going to try to get there. A lot of good ideas that were in the pipeline similar to that. So you could do both. You need to either have a bigger team and be committed to those directions, or you got to kind of do them one after the other, whatever order, doesn't matter, right? Do competition first and software, or software competition, who cares? Just pick a direction and go with it. You know what I mean? And I just felt like it was kind of like, oh, we should do it for everybody. And that was where like I would get frustrated, is telling me what I do matters. Great. I believe you. I'm here for it. Let's do it. Also, 50 million other things kind of conflict with what I'm doing. And then suddenly I felt like I was in a feeding frenzy to try to justify like what I was doing was good. And when I would get really frustrated at work, that would be what it was. you know, and that comes with every job. But I think for Zwift, it's because I cared so much, hence the forums in the beginning. I was very critical of that, right? And that's where my frustration would come from, because I wanted to see it succeed, because it is pretty unique and pretty novel. You know, it's a cool thing. So anyway, I got a bit off the rails. Hopefully that answered your question, or at least what that was, what you're talking about.
I'm loving this side. I don't know about you, but I'm glad that we were able to track down Foot. So you talk about the, you know, the balancing act between the community,
sure,
the soft and the hard markets, right? The,
yeah,
the accessibility. The one of the major issues that seems to get in the way is the perception of cheating on the platform.
Yeah,
I'm curious to get your view. You know, what do you think about the level of cheating at the community level on Zwift? How would you characterize that from your position?
If you want to be like reductive about it or make broad strokes, at least for the sake of time, you can pretty much lump it into two buckets, right? Like there's the what we call internally like the elite community. So your really high B's to A category folks, right? That are like on the platform racing a lot. They're probably enjoying some level of success outside of their local cycling organization, you know, well-known local legends, what have you. Those are like the really good folks that kind of people start to know, right? So you have all of those folks on the one end, and then on the other end, you have everyone else who are maybe that softer audience, or, you know, someone's parent who is just looking to lose a little weight, or the person that used to have a bike 30 years ago, they're getting back into it, whatever, right? And they kind of happen upon competition. But the cheating thing is really, if you separate into those two buckets, it kind of becomes a little difficult to pin down and then address. So if you look at the elite community portion of it, I believe that the cheating in those events, and this is not going to, like, I'm not super beholden to this. I'm also trying to hedge my bets in case people come back at me and they message me and say, like, you're crazy. But the problem is, or one of the bigger problems is the way that people cheat in those races affects a lot more people than are engaging in it. So for instance, like Simon, let's say you're a dirty, rotten cheater on Zwift, right? And you are racing with me, Chris, and 50 other people. So there's 53 of us in this race. If you cheat, 52 other people have a bad race. And then it seems like there's a lot of cheating going on, because what happens is, if you're holding like some incredibly high watts per kilo or some unrealistic speed or whatever, right? Like the 52 other people are then trying to chase back on, because they may not know that you are cheating in whatever way that you're doing it, unless it's like glaringly obvious. And then, as is the nature of cheating, it becomes more sinister and more subversive over time and harder to detect. And it just never really ends. You know, we've seen that with doping programs. Like sport has this problem, period, right? People are going to figure out new ways to bend the rules. In Zwift, it's harder to see, because unlike on your local group ride in person, you know that like last year Simon wasn't that strong and suddenly he came back way too fit. He's probably on the sauce or something. You can't see that in Zwift other than a few numbers. And there's also this, so there's like that anonymous element, right? But at the top level in the elite community, that's really like the pervasive way to do it. Then on the other hand, you have the bigger problem, which is inadvertent cheating. Because people just don't really have like a way to understand that what they're doing is probably above the bounds of human performance to some extent, because they're not sitting here reading papers and on the Zwift forums and every other Discord and like looking at, you know, all the, like, they're not as familiar with it, and that's fine. They're just doing it for fun, but they don't know, like, and I would handle these emails to some extent, like early on in my job, where people are like, hey, this guy's cheating. And then I go look at their profile. And it's, you know, someone in their mid-50s and they have an FTP of like 600, and then you email them and they're like, I don't know, I just bought like a spin bike because I just wanted to ride. And like, they don't really understand it. And then they feel bad, and then it's weird, right? So you have to address the elite community thing, which can be done any number of ways. The solutions are never perfect. The other is, how do we prevent people from inadvertently cheating and just disrupting this thing without knowing that they're doing it? When it comes down to actionable, tangible things, the elite community are the most vocal. I totally understand that, and I agree with it. Like, it sucks because you're here literally sweating, you know, your ass off, sorry the language, and you're getting smoked by somebody and you're like, there's no way this could happen because I'm fit, what, you know, whatever. A lot of it just comes down to being able to detect and then understand frequency. And we had been starting to do this December. We had started to put some measures in place for like sticky watts and stuff to even just be able to like quantify it, because I mean, very openly, I knew cheating existed. I just wasn't even aware of like how much it was, because it seems like so much more than it is, right? Again, back to our example, if Simon's cheating, there's 52 of us that think like, oh, everybody's cheating in this race, but because we're all trying to chase back on, maybe it's, you know, him and someone else in the league, right? Like, it's very muddy and hard to detect. So for any number of reasons, but as with many things, it's a long rabbit hole to go down. So I'll stop it right there. Does that answer what you wanted to hear?
It kind of did. You used the words glaringly obvious. A lot of times it is glaringly obvious, even in the elite ranks it is.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Is there any motivation to prevent it? Because as of now, there are, you know, the only real prevention techniques that are being employed by community organizers.
Yep.
Like if you do the Zwift games, there, you know, if you go onto the forums, you know, there's 20 different posts talking about guys that are holding 8 watts per kilo for a 30-minute race. And, you know, at every level that you're on. Yeah. The question I'm asking is there a motivation to eliminate cheating, knowing that it's going to decrease the accessibility, decrease subs, hurt the bottom line?
That part I don't know, the bottom line bit, right? Like, and that's kind of where I was getting at, like the quantification, because like, let's say we have 5 people a year that are cheating, right? You ban those people. Cool. 5 people are never coming back out of the however many that are there. Like, that's a drop in the bucket. The inadvertent cheating I also brought up, because that's where like it got really sticky, right? That's not a pun for sticky watts, but it got contentious internally. So I would say the motivation exists, right? Like, everybody was in agreement, like, yeah, we got to do something. It was really hard to decide what should we do and to what level, because on the one hand, as I mentioned, you don't know how to quantify it depending on what the issue is. You know it exists, but you're maybe not as aware of like how prevalent it is. In the glaringly obvious instances, there are certain things that don't prevent those people from abusing the system. There's a very now infamous individual who has many, many, many accounts. And, you know, that's for similar protections, right? So there's some like systemic stuff. Simon, you were asking about architecture earlier. That's always going to be a factor. Motivation is yes, but I think basically it felt like, let's see if I can sum this up quickly. There's an indecision or inaction that results as the realization that any solution is going to be like a band-aid solution and probably will displease some group of people to some extent and probably cause more problems in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, cheating is kind of this never-ending hunt when you're looking for people, right? To try to get rid of them. In the instances where it's glaringly obvious, I've given out plenty of bans myself. I used to do that on Zwift Power. That was like prior to my product management thing. That whole forum post that people linked to that I put up about the forum, like, I spearheaded that. Is it good? No. It was my very first attempt to try to like do something, because like we didn't have anything. So I was like, whatever. But even that, you know, it takes a lot of effort. So it really came down to like, can we identify it? How do we find the people that have the knowledge to make the decisions correctly? Can I train them? You know, who needs the knowledge, right? Like, because coaches that know Zwift are not very easy to come by, as an example, and people that know like watts per kilo stuff in relation to Zwift, not super easy to come by, and then can, you know, communicate. Like, you're looking for a very small pool of people. And then the other thing is, could we then scale it out? And then could we, you know, have like the very entry-level folks doing support for like your most mundane issues, have them also do it, right? So it kind of became this quickly like massive thing. There is motivation. I don't think there's agreement on how to do it. And I was kind of part of that. I disagreed on a lot of stuff because I thought, if we're going to do it, we better do it right. This is a year-long project. We need to do it correctly. I'm not just going to band-aid solution it like I did before. I'm in a form that people now mock and meme, you know? So anyway.
So just, I want to just close this topic with one thing. Those people, sure, you know, that can do it are doing it, and they're the community organizers, right? They're there, you know, that's there. There are race series that are run with authentic racers that are being monitored and identified as cheats, and they're being, you know, sanctioned and no longer being able to race. Possibility is there. You know, that's why I think it looks to a lot of people like there isn't a motivation to crack down, because there are people that are out that are doing it and doing it successfully.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And they all have slightly different methodologies, which I admire and I've always liked. I'm a big proponent of, as much as it may not seem that way, and I'm not just trying to say this to like win anybody's votes, like I'm not kissing babies and shaking hands. I'm a big proponent of like community action and then borrowing from what is successful with the community and working with them. The sticking point there is there's no integration from Zwift. As people know, there's little to no integration on Zwift's end to be able to subsume any of those things successfully. And then when you take it on as Zwift, the company that is the platform, it starts to mean a whole lot different, right? So, you know, you, Chris, could put on a race series and sanction people according to your own rules. And we encourage that. And in our original, like, Zwift Power subsumption, when I was helping with all this documentation and training support staff on it, I would tell them, like, if people come to you and they say they got disqualified and it's a community-owned race, we don't touch that. We shouldn't, because it's their rules and that person needs to follow up with the community organizer, because we want to empower them to do it. It was like a really dead, broken, gnarled, semi-burnt olive branch to the community to say, like, keep doing what you're doing. Sorry, I don't have the tools, but I'm not going to step on your toes and say that we know better, because we don't even have the ability for us to do that right now. Right? So yeah, I'm with you. Community can do it. What I would love is some kind of open, you know, door, for lack of a better metaphor, for the community to go through and do their thing freely with Zwift's support in the technical way, right? So.
I think that's a really interesting bit of the discussion there. And of course, you know, the community are doing it, as Chris said there. But of course, Zwift also used to do it with Zarda, which are, you know, now Indievelo. And this is going to move us on to the next topic, which is elite racing. But what I will say on that is, you know, what I heard from what was happening with Indievelo and the who they were testing, who were they not testing, what they were looking at, is it was a very limited selection of those elite riders in the Zwift Games and the Zwift Grand Prix, for example. But I want to focus on elite racing.
Okay.
And I want to try understand, you know, from what you could see on the inside there, you know, where is the commitment? Is there a commitment to elite racing at Zwift?
Yes, but, or yes and, depending on if you're an improv actor or whatever, we're sorry with that joke, doesn't matter. The people who I feel the worst for in terms of, like, are they being served by Zwift, are that elite community group of people. Because I think they're the hardest to deal with. Not because they're, like, vocal and, you know, we can't ever please them. It's not from that. I think it's because it's a really unique thing, right? So elite racing. And I had actually... we had hired somebody who was going to be my counterpart to do specifically elite racing, and I was getting him up to speed on all the stuff that I had learned over the last few years. Elite racing really came down to elite in a professional sense. Like, are you making money? Are you UCI? Are you Continental, right? Like, are you a professional cyclist? Or are you these high A folks that just do it for fun? Elite community versus elite professionals. Elite professionals is a lot easier to deal with. And so the approach that we had talked about taking was, we should focus on them first, because then we could probably start to build it out in waves, right? And trickle it down. And I don't like Ronald Reagan and trickle down economics, but I think that this time it would work, where, like, if you can serve a few people, you can start to serve a lot more by, like, growing that out and scaling it. So I think Zwift were committed to that for sure. I don't know what they're doing now. But the internal discussion, and this is where, like, again, Sean Perry comes back into the conversation and my work with Johnny, and, like, those guys are super smart. If you haven't talked to them, try to talk to them. They've got a lot to say. They're, like, really, really good dudes. Everybody at Zwift is, actually. Yep. We had made the distinction, Sean and I, pretty early on, of, like, all right, cool. So there's elite racing for, like, UCI bids and, you know, the stuff, I think, where you guys are more focused on, like, esports, right? Like, as a viable kind of profession thing. That's, like, a whole different can of worms than the elite community. But they kind of work together. And it's different insofar as that, like, elite community is the tip of the pyramid where you start to scale out, and then it becomes, you know, your parents and your grandparents and whatever, who are just kind of on the platform for fun, right? But it always starts back a professional. And I believe that because, like, sorry, I have like six thoughts going, so I don't feel like I'm being coherent, but I'm going to try to make this work. Cycling in and of itself as a sport takes notes from professionals, even if most of us aren't professionals, right? Like, we care about what Vanderpool's doing. We care about what shoes he's got on. You know, we care about, like, the women's tour. We care about, like, who won Roubaix. I'll never do Roubaix. That looks awful. I don't want to do that, but I love that race and I want to try to emulate the bike setup or whatever, right? And so we kind of took that tack at Zwift, because I think on the one hand, it gives you credibility because it shows like you are invested in like the very heart of the sport that has this long rooted tradition. And then on the other hand, it is a much smaller, more manageable group, right? So if you're talking about ZADA, you're exactly right. Yeah, it's small groups of people. They do huge in-depth analyses on it. And I would help them with that to some extent by pulling files or giving people information about like, oh, what trainer was this person on? Or like, can you give me their game logs and all this kind of stuff, right? Like I was pretty closely working with those guys. That was where the other part about the scalability I mentioned earlier comes back into play though. And that kind of weird knowledge set is, you know, the folks at ZADA would spend anywhere from like 4 to 6 hours to like several weeks looking at one person. You want to hire 50 people at Zwift to do that? That's like a ridiculous use of money. But on the other hand, how can you automate that with any sort of confidence, right? So when it comes to elite racing, there's that whole cheating side, which I just kind of, I think, poorly communicated to you. But then there's the other part, which is the visible part of like, do we get the UCI bid? Are we supporting the tour? Are we giving, you know, Vanderpool the visibility, that kind of stuff? Those two things should be harmonious. I think they're kind of at odds with one another. Because to do one, you need the other, but they must exist in symbiosis, if that makes sense. So they want to do it. I don't know that they know exactly how to support that, but people are trying. So does that make sense?
It does. Just two things. you mentioned automating the performance verification.
Yeah.
I have indications from sources that there are members of ZADA who could do that tomorrow if Zwift would contract them to do it. Second thing is, you mentioned that you were bringing somebody up to speed, an elite guy, right? Is that guy still with the company or
no? No, he got canned same time as I did, and I felt really bad for him. He's a great dude, super excited, super passionate. Sat in on it, like one of his interviews, right? Like I kind of got to see him from the start of his Zwift life until the very end of it, which was cut drastically short. If you want to be a little bit extremist, but it never really came to fruition, but there was like a larger push internally to like sit down and basically be much more dedicated to like elite cycling, right? Like professional esports cycling on Zwift. And he was going to spearhead that from product point of view, and product being very broad in the sense of like the product is elite esports cycling. And so we need to solve the problems for that user base. That can be things from the client, to the server authority, to how do we deal with cheating, how do we make the broadcast better, right? Like all the stuff that goes into that is what he was going to spearhead, which previously was under me, which is probably why it languished, partly because I was pretty junior and also because like you can't do community and elite racing at the same time to any level of efficacy with the size of the team we had, just like you can't be Zwift and do competition and the, you know, quote unquote software audience at the same time with any level of efficacy. You just have to pick your direction and go, right?
So. You've opened up so many avenues of topic. I knew this would happen when we spoke, given what I saw last time. But, you know, you mentioned a few things there, and I'm just, you mentioned the trickle-down effect. I actually will say that myself and Chris met and spoke to someone else at Zwift on the racing team who spoke about the opposite of building from the base up. So, it does feel to me. And also, I'm just looking at that, you know, you're not there anymore. The esports guy you just mentioned is not anymore. ZADA's no longer in-house. All these things have been pointed that they're not supporting elite. One of the things that myself and Chris have also spoke about, you mentioned there Van der Poel, for example. And if I look at who Zwift promote from a racing point of view, it's the Van der Poels. It's the elite racers on the road. Yep. I personally don't think Zwift have done. I think they're doing a better job this time around. Very good job of promoting the cycling esports stars, you know, the Zach Neers, the James Barnes, you know, and all, you know, Lionel Vuillasans of this world and so on. And doing it from that way round. So, you know, it doesn't feel like it's going in the right direction really to me. The other question that I've got to ask is, why do you think that Kurt Biedler resigned?
I have no idea why Kurt resigned. I met Kurt on a number of occasions. He's a nice guy, you know, like I didn't hate him. I didn't love him. I didn't feel apathy toward him. I was like, yeah, he's a pretty good dude. He felt pretty relatable. I don't know what happens in the C-suite. I don't envy that position of anybody. And I think Zwift in particular is a unique business with a unique set of problems that needs the right type of people to run it. Kurt was not the wrong type of person. Maybe he felt that he wasn't doing an exemplary job and stepped down. I can never know what conversation led to that, either with his family or with Eric Mann or whoever. No idea. No idea at all. But, you know, he was a cool dude. I met him in a cross race up here. He's totally fine. Broke his derailleur and put it through his spoke, which was a bummer, but he's human just like the rest of us, right? So,
well, breaking your derailleur and put it through your spoke is probably the way that a lot of people thought the tender for the Esports World Championship went.
Yeah, I guess.
Right? When we got that news, it was pretty much a shock, you know, to a lot of people, not to everybody, not to all of us, but to a lot of people. You mentioned the C-suite, you know, the philosophy as far as that's concerned. UCI, you know, what do you think is the reason why Zwift wasn't able to win that bit?
Well, interestingly enough, I wasn't super privy to a lot of the conversations, right? Like the UCI is kind of like the Wonka factory sometimes where like nobody comes in, nobody goes out, nobody knows what's going on. They just sort of produce stuff and you're like, all right, like I guess they're the cycling body. And at other times they're like just disgustingly transparent. You figure out ways to be like, I don't like them, right? So it's anybody's guess. Sean and Johnny were a lot closer to those conversations than I was. I never barked up their tree because it took a lot of their time. They're also in the UK, so they were always 8 hours ahead of me, and I would get kind of second and third hand. My guess is that, you know, Woosh has deep pockets, and the UCI probably was like, yeah, this seems like maybe a sure thing, and we're not as certain about Zwift, but Woosh will give us what we want more than Zwift will. And to whatever extent that is, I have no clue. For as much as I was in competition, I was the most detached from the professional side of things because a lot of it was relationships that I didn't have, wasn't brought onto. And like, that's not because I'm not bitter about that. I should, you know, make no bones, but I was just always more focused on the community side of it because I always felt that that was kind of like where the true meat, you know, lay, so to speak, of like, this is what we should be focusing on personally. The esports stuff is cool. It's a kind of a pipe dream. And like, yeah, it'd be rad to see Zwift in the Olympics or like a much more legitimate in the eyes of whoever, you know, esports jersey. I just kind of felt like Zwift got it because we were the only folks that could do it for a while. And then Woosh maybe made a more convincing case. And maybe that had to do with cash, but I really don't know.
All right. Well, let me ask another question relating to the World Championships then. What was the feeling within Zwift when that announcement came? You know, were you disappointed? You know, you were semi-close to that race team, I guess. So what was the feeling in the organization when that announcement came?
The general feeling was like, it was kind of mixed. And not mixed with like excitement and anger. It was more like, probably actually how I felt when I got laid off. Like, really? That's your choice? Okay. Like, you know, not because like they're making the wrong one, but it just sort of felt like it was almost a foregone conclusion. We were like, oh yeah, we're going to try to get Worlds. We still have to put in the bid and whatever. But, you know, I know a lot of hard work went into that. Sean raked himself over the coals for months for that. And there was no lack of preparation on Zwift's end for sure. It was definitely disappointing. But I don't think it was met with anger or bitterness or cynicism or anybody being jaded. It was actually, all right, cool. Hey, maybe this is an opportunity for us as Zwift to kind of get it together in the eyes of the UCI and come back even better. You know, like it's similar to how cyclists approach any number of races, right? Maybe you have a crap season because you had injury, but you're going to come back better next year, or you're really focusing on whatever classic or whatever grand tour. So you're willing to kind of take flack during the season leading up to that in order to reach your goal. It was very much that. It was like, okay, determination. Like we want to get this back. So let's do it and let's try to make it right. Hence why I brought up, you know, the guy that I was going to be working with for elite stuff. And we're going to be the Statler and Waldorf of competition on Zwift and, you know, like make it better. And like, that was, yeah. So anyway, I felt like it was good. As much as it was confusing, but it wasn't, nobody was really like super pissed.
So for people listening, when they hear somebody who was an integral member of the competition team, think, you know, speak about elite level esports in the Olympics as a pipe dream, that's probably, doesn't, you know, it's kind of makes them, you know, have questions about the commitment. And I know that when we discussed the esports, we, you know, the word complacency came up a number of times. You know, it's a little bit frustrating when people talk about, you know, that there might have been a financial component to the tender. when a lot of the things that you've told us in this interview point towards another reason why it could potentially be.
From the community standpoint, I understand why complacency would be the word that comes to mind. And when I say pipe dream for the Olympics, I want to make it clear, like, that's for me personally, right? Like, I would love to see that. And it was kind of the chatter around the company. I never believed that that's what we were going to do in the next, say, 3-4 years, maybe the next Olympics, right? Like in 8 to 12. But there was a lot of work that needed to be done to get there. And I felt like, while I mentioned, yeah, going from the top down, that was only in relation to performance verification. I'm sorry, cheating. We call it performance verification internally. But there's a lot of bottom-up stuff that can be done. Hence things like racing score, you know, hence things like trying to make racing better for everybody, like whether it's your hardcore community folks or your first-timers or whatever. There's just so many other areas of opportunity in my mind that we could have focused on. But I think that gave the impression of, like, yeah, complacency in relation to, like, elite professional stuff. But that's a very niche space, as you guys definitely know. And I think those problems are not simple to solve. It's just kind of a lot of complexity. So with all that being said.
No, I think you handled it very well. I don't know, Sai. This has been great. Someone's got to hire this guy. Someone's got to hire this guy immediately.
I hope so, yeah, man. Well, I mean, the LinkedIn life is exhausting.
Well, I know you've been getting a lot of skiing and Flint, and look, yeah. You know, I think your passion for the sport, the industry is absolutely key. And, you know, and coming back to what you said there, I think the reason why you were loved within the forums and people in the community like me is because we could see that you were trying to, you know, yeah. What you were trying to deliver and what you were trying to communicate, even if sometimes internally, you know, it may have not been the corporate line. We could see that in the forum. So, you know, we for one really appreciate that and you know, all the hard work that you put in to trying to get the Zwift Racing score. I'm sure the community hope that we see that at some point. First and foremost, though, Flint, I want to wish you all the best for the future. I want to really thank you for coming on today and the best success with whatever role I'm sure is going to come your way in the coming weeks or months.
I hope so. Thank you.
Wish you all the best.
All right, Chris, a really interesting chat with Flint there. Obviously, clearly a passionate guy. And we know Flint, you know, he just wants the sport to succeed. And we wish him all the best in the future. But there is a lot to get on with, Chris, and talk to. So we'll leave that out there for the community to listen, digest, feedback and comment on what they've just heard from Flint McInnes there, former employee of Zwift. We've got to talk about these UCI, because they've released the National Federation quotas for the World Championships, Chris, the new qualification system. Do you want to give us a bit more insight? Because I know you've written an article on it recently, so you have the numbers right in front of you, I guess.
Yeah, so this is one of the last things that I guess Michael Rogers did before he left the UCI, was he created this new algorithm for the number of riders that were going to be brought in by the federations for the semifinal. So basically, the top 60 finishers in the men's and women's fields in the last two UCI Esports World Championships receives points based on the finishing positions. So basically, if you had a certain number of your riders finishing in the top 60, you got that's based on the UCI points system for all of their international level races. So from that, they put into groups, and it's in the article. They're all listed out, but max of 10 going down to, I think, two or three. So 10.
Yeah, tell me about it. It's three for the British team. That's our allocation based on the points gathered from the team there. So
it's not. It's 10, Sai. So you're going to get us in trouble because it's 10 for the women,
10
three
for
the men.
Chris,
so the strong part of the British team got 10.
Oh no, I'm in for a telling off after this show. There's going to be some comments there. You're right.
Oh, you're going to get it, Sai.
Oh, I can see the emails in the forum chat about me already. You are exactly right, Chris. The women, the very successful women, get Great Britain get 10, but the British men only get 3. So I guess the question is the quota fair? How they've done it currently? I think my comment, Chris, first of all on that is they haven't got a lot else to base it on. Because it's not, you know, we've spoke about having these UCI-sanctioned events that basically don't exist right now. So I guess in terms of UCI-sanctioned events, the only thing they can base it on are the two world championships that have previously taken place.
Yeah, I guess, or you could look to, you know, the real-world system, which I don't really know offhand, and they have, you know, geez, shame on me that I didn't look that up. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you show a commitment and you're... Because of that, your racers do well, then, you know, you, I think you deserve to get a few more races into the semifinals. And just because they're in the semifinals doesn't mean that you're going to have like a dominant squad in the finals. You have to make it through to the finals. In the past, very few of the teams actually worked as a team. It's been, in my estimation, it's been a bunch of individuals wearing the same jerseys. Whether that's going to happen this year and whether the format, you know, basically facilitates more of a team aspect, I think, you know, is, you know, remains to be seen. It makes it really interesting.
So my concern now is the future, is not this World Championships, because it is what it is, right? But the next one, if the men, for example, we've only got three British men, you know, so just in terms of statistically, the chances of those three guys finishing in the top 10 is a lot less given the numbers that we have there. So then if we base the next World Championships 2025 on the previous three World Championships, we're going to potentially be in the same situation. And it could potentially take many years till the Great Britain men, for example, get a similar quota to the Australians, for example. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems like it's like a downward spiral for those teams. And yeah, if you know, in that respect, I think that it's probably going to have to be looked at again. It's going to have to be readdressed because, you know, for that reason, it certainly could be problematic.
But I guess first and foremost, we've seen some of the qualifications completed already by the federations, but I think there's still a lot that have not done that. Or, no, actually, let me put it another way. There's a lot of federations who've had their national championships. Whether they would class those as a qualification pathway is a different question. We know USAC, for example, in theory, on paper, did their qualification races as part of the Echelon League, as it was, as well as their national championships. But there's not much time, Chris, because those public qualification races, I think six races over 6 weeks, they're going to take place May, June 2024, and the top 25 riders in those will secure the spot in the semifinals. But then that only leaves this month, essentially. That leaves April for any of the other federations to complete their qualification process, or, like UK have done previously, are they just going to select riders?
It's interesting. I sent an inquiry off to My Wish to get some more details about the qualification pathway. And they said that we really don't have much to say. So I have a feeling that that timing isn't necessarily set in stone. But one of the things that I do know, I spoke to USA Cycling, and they tell me that they are going to have a qualification series that's going to be on My Wish. They also are going to honor any athletes that qualified by the previous criteria. They're reworking the criteria. They're going to include this new series or race, single race series, whatever they're going to do on My Wish for qualification also. So that is still a work in progress over there.
I was going to say, just before we get on to Michael Rogers, though, I think you can sense some of my frustration because I'm a proud British guy here. So I'm just worried about the future of our cycling esports. But of course, you and I, well, actually, let's just wrap that up. 80% of the qualifiers will come through the federations. 20% will be able to access through that public qualification that we said will take place in May and June. And then there's still these wild cards. So essentially, that's 150 riders that are going to move forward into the semi-finals. I want to just focus on the UK team for a moment because you and I did speak to Thomas Turner from British Cycling recently. And, you know, it's still quite clear. I remember going on the Rap podcast and mentioning Cam Jeffers at some point because I used to watch a lot of his YouTube videos. But his name comes up again still all these years on, and I don't know if people realize, but that incident of those British national championships still hangs, you know, a dark cloud over cycling esports. And it was clear to me from that conversation that they were still a little bit burned from that situation, and this is why we've not seen a UK national championships since then.
Oh yeah, it was very clear when we spoke to Mr. Turner that was still had a sour taste in the federation's mouth over there. And it's kind of funny. I was riding with Coco, and I came upon Thomas Perrin, and he says, "Chris, you know, it's really upsetting that all these federations are having national championships, and you know, we don't have one of our own." And I mentioned the fact that the Cam Jeffers incident, and wouldn't you know that probably a half dozen people that were riding was like, "That has nothing to do with it. That's just an excuse." You know,
Yep. It
was really polarizing. So you say it's just an excuse, but it's obviously upsetting to you too, you know?
Well, it is, because I remember I mentioned his name. Well, I didn't. I was holding back from mentioning his name on the rap, and Anna Russell said to me, well, you can say his name. He's not Voldemort, but you might say there is that cloud hanging over Cycling Esports and the UK, you know, Federation from that point of view. So, but I tell you what, let's jump on then to talking about some of those live events, those national championships we saw. Because, of course, Sweden, they held their Federation's national championships. I have to say, all these national championships, they look like incredible live events, Chris.
I really think that the backbone of our sport progressing has to go through the national federations.
Yep.
So whenever I see one of them that I think is doing the right thing, I track them down and I interview them. So I interviewed the chairman of esports for the Swedish Cycling Federation. His name is Conny Bjornhall. Really great guy. Totally all in esports. And he's made some incredible inroads in Sweden. He was able to get cycling esports acknowledged as a sport in the country. So it's like one of their national sports. They compete in the national Swedish Championship Week. They have a certain number of winter sports that compete for like a week-long festival, and cycling esports was the first and possibly the only esport that's actually in that. And that's where this live final was. It's just, you know, they fully support their athletes. They have an esports specific license for them. They insure the athletes, they give them kit, they give them travel expenses, and they have esports-specific sponsors that fund them. They have national television networks that televise the races. He said something like they're in like 100,000 homes. You know, it's amazing what can be done when the federation buys in.
I think it's both those. And, well, you and I have both spoken to MyWoosh, and we spoke to Bart at MyWoosh, and his job is to liaise with some of those federations and make sure they can get access to the platform for those national championships. But I think it's both of those things, right? We've got to elevate the stars internationally, you know, and I think MyWoosh and UCI hopefully will do that. And I'm talking about the cycling esports stars, not the cycling stars, the cycling esports stars, and start to, you know, elevate those individuals to be household names, as it were, but also, yeah, in conjunction with those local federations, those national federations. And I think Sweden, Denmark, or cycling are doing a great job of that. So did you also speak to someone from Danish Cycling Federation as well? Because, again, I saw their streamed national championships and another fantastic event at a live venue.
Yeah, they are the director over there, Martin Hjongard. I'm terrible with these pronunciations, but great guy, extremely knowledgeable, all in on cycling esports. You know, they do something that's really cool too, and you probably saw it when one of their athletes won the world championships. The whole entire national team is competing in the same room. There are coaches walking around coaching them up. You know, their tactics, their strategy. You know, there's the motivation of being in the room with your teammates. You know, that type of thing is what the sport needs to move forward. And that was televised. They had sponsors. You know, I think Garmin, you know, gave them all the equipment that they needed, all of these things. They were fully supported. And, you know, he's going forward with that.
Yeah, well, the other one we got to talk about, because, I mean, this man, Romain Mavril from Hexagon, of course, he's not just organized the French National Championships, but we've seen multiple live events and different events organized by him as an individual and by that team in France for the French National Championships too. So another great job. But we've got to talk about the Australian National Championships, because it was really interesting, because I think David Lepontier was also at that event, right?
Yeah, you know, when I was watching the YouTube video, first of all, what an event. I would be there in a second.
Those screens were incredible, right?
It seemed like it could have been just the perfect place to just like sit at a bar stool with your wife and just watch the racing and just take it all in. You know what I mean? But I think that it was kind of glossed over a little bit in the commentary that UCI president David Lepontien was there sitting alongside Australia's Olympic Committee president. Right? When I see these live events, the first thing that comes to my mind is that these are all, you know, basically auditions for the Olympics. Right? Now we need to get this right. And by all accounts, you know, it looked incredible, but there were some issues.
Yeah, well, what I will say just about those Oz cycling, I agree, but I will say that the way that they do the commentary in Australia is, and I love that Yeah. Kate Bates and the co-host. What, you know, I think it's that they've also got a podcast. I think it's called the Wheelhouse yeah. podcast, something like that.
Right,
phenomenal. And you know, and Kate clearly knows the platform. She's done a lot of work with Zwift and so on. So she can identify when issues are happening. And you know, but that's exactly like you said. I could listen to those two with a beer and a cold beer on a sunny day watching those national championships. But you're right, there were issues there, and I know we both spoken to it. A few riders there. I think you got a statement from OzCycling on some of the hardware issues that they experienced. Well, I'm assuming they were hardware issues.
I didn't make any assumptions, but when I reached out to OzCycling, I said, listen, you know, there, you know, we have these technical issues. Can you explain, you know, what the reasons were? And do you feel that it impacted the event at all? Because there were, you know, there were a lot of people, the athletes were on both sides. The athletes that were there were on both sides. Some of them that it affected were like, you know, this happens. It was such a great event. I was so grateful to be there, and it was a great race experience. And there were other people that were there that weren't affected that thought that, you know, here we go again, you know, it's just the Olympics all over, and you know, we can't have this happening. So I reached out to OzCycling, and they were nice enough to get back to me, and I'm just going to read the statement. I'm going to try to, you know, read through it as quickly as possible, but they came right out of the gate and said the most likely cause of the issue was a loss of connectivity in the hardware between some of the bikes and the on-site central connection. We were able to solve this by checking the connections and rebooting all the bikes between races. After we did this, the issue did not reoccur. They go on to saying that we tested them extensively, but we probably could have tested them a bit more. However, as with any cycling discipline, equipment problems and external disruptions are a reality of competition. We need to be prepared to respond to that. And in this case, I'm happy to say we did so successfully. We had experts from Zwift, Wahoo, and staff from the place, you know, the venue where they were, to help us troubleshoot the issue and restart the event quickly. So I don't know. They pivoted and they did what they had to do. They made a decision. They got everybody back online. I don't like when people say a dropout is a flat tire, right? Or, you know, a connectivity issue is a flat tire. Yeah. Because if I get a flat tire on my bike, it's because I'm using crappy tubes and I have worn tires.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, but I'm just focusing on the athletes for a moment, because I think you're right. The athletes dealt with it really well at the venue. And the fact, you know, the men's race particularly had a few issues there, and, you know, how they got the agreement across all right. I mean, those problems shouldn't happen. I agree. And I'm surprised they did, because, you know, arguably, you know, they got some of the best hardware there that you could possibly have with the Wahoo. They tend to be pretty robust, I would say, and troubleshoot these things pretty well. But, yeah, just focus on the athletes. I've got to say, you know, for me, I'm a little bit biased, Chris, but obviously Kate trod in there in OzCycling. She's a BL13 rider, as is a partner, Josh Harris, I say. And, you know, for me, I was that focused on watching Kate and shouting for Kate win, because, of course, she was wearing a Level Velo jersey. So I've got to say, I'm a little bit biased, but that was good to see from my point of view.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a sharp jersey. And I interviewed her, and she is a huge star in the making. And the power couple is really cool, you know, with her and Josh, because Josh is a great guy too. He's just such a genuine, big time talent, and just, you know, couldn't be any nicer. But you know, we didn't get to speak to Zwift when we went out to Long Beach, but we did get to speak to Jacob Frazier, and we spoke to him at length. He is one of the guys that did the first live in venue event that Zwift supported and that was successful. He says to me, Chris, these events are so tenuous. Like, you're one tiny little blip away from somebody getting a dropout. You know, the fact that these things happen is not unusual, and it should somewhat be accepted because it happens. And, you know, it's, in some cases, it's just unavoidable. There are so many factors involved. There are so many sources of interference. You know, there's some, you know, somebody can, you know, I think that what happened with in the Swedish Federation is that somebody's towel, like, knocked the connector out. You know what I mean? There are so many different things that can happen. Like, you could step on the, you know, the dongle with your foot. You know what I mean? Like, there are so many things that can happen. And he also went on to tell me, when I discussed it with him this week, is that we don't have any purpose-built solution for this. Every time that one of these events happens, it has to be built up from scratch. So when you think about it, like, you know, maybe we need to have a standard in place. Maybe, you know, the platform says if you're going to hold, or the UCI or whoever says if you're going to hold one of these events, then these are the minimum standards that you have to adhere to. And we have to come by and make sure that you're doing that. Like you have a set testing protocol. You have a set, you know, direct connect routing protocol. You know, these wires go this way and these wires go that way. And you can't have the monitors so close to the devices and all these other things. You know, there's a lot, but you know, like I said, if we're going to have this as a consumable product, can't be like restarting races in the middle and then shortening them because we're afraid that there's something's going to happen.
No. But I think that is going to lead me on to the next question. But when I say the positive thing, the athletes did a great job. But also on all of those national championships, the race format I thought was really good. They all pretty much took it down to small field size races for the finals. And from what I know, what I believe as well from you know, that cycling esports races, that's when it works best with cycling esports. Not when you've got 100 riders, as we saw in some of the Zwift games. You know, we had that last discussion, of course, with Ollie Jones and Lionel Vuillasan in the last podcast. Getting those events down to small field sizes, publicly nationally televised events like we saw, you know, broadcast and streamed in many locations. But just coming back to what you said there about the technology and having this standardized, of course, that does lead us on to Michael Rogers, because now he's left the UCI in his role, which was specifically focused on, well, it was technology, I think, or innovation and cycling esports. So have you got any insights, Chris, of why he's left?
I wish I did. It's not a mystery to anybody that when I spoke to Michael Rogers, I was extremely impressed by him. Like I sincerely believe that he had a very strong vision for cycling esports. You know, we spoke at length. I don't know, but I also know that esports was only half of his job, right? He was also involved in innovation. I don't think that's an easy job. I don't want to be the one, you know, telling you that your helmet is the one that you're supposed to be wearing, you know, your sock height and things like that. It just seems like it's like a thankless job. There are a lot of opinions there, and perhaps he didn't like the direction, but I do not know exactly. But what I do know is that he seemed to be like sincerely upset with the fact that he wasn't able to see the trainer homologation program through, that he wasn't able to see the international calendar and the international ranking system through, all these initiatives that he started. I think that, you know, I think that he's saddened by the fact that he's not able to do that. I think it's a sad day for cycling esports that he's no longer at the helm.
Yeah, no, I do agree. And like I say, we wait to see what's going to happen with those programs that you've mentioned, I guess. And for me, you know, it was really moving in the right direction, having these cycling esports solidified under the UCI, because I'm not one of these, Chris, who believes that it should be with an esports organization. I believe cycling esports should sit with the UCI, and I believe it should sit with the cycling federations nationally. But we, of course, when we were in LA together, we met with Jacob Fraser. My understanding is, or from what I think I've read there, is Jacob Fraser is sort of going to step up to the role or take some of those responsibilities in the short term. Is that right?
Well, he's been a consultant for the UCI for a good while now. I couldn't give you the exact date, but a year, maybe more. He is one of the most knowledgeable people that I know about cycling esports from the very beginning. Like he worked for Zwift, he worked for MyWish, you know, started off, you know, basically, you know, was there for the origins of both of those programs. He has a depth of knowledge, like I said, about the in-person live events, you know, just about the governance of the sport. And you know, he has a very strong vision for the way it should go and has a big hand in presenting that to the Olympic program as well. I think that the department there is in good hands if he's in a position where he's able to make some decisions. Whether that's happening, I'm not really sure. Do I think that he would like to assume that job? I'm a little bit skeptical about that. He has a family in California, a young family, and I don't think he wants to uproot them and bring them to Switzerland. There are a lot of factors involved. And then so the next question is, you know, where is Michael going to land, right? He's got a pretty unique skill set for you know, that many companies would certainly covet.
Yeah, well, that's it. Obviously, he's been with the UCI, he's been with Virtua Pro, so maybe he lands with another platform. We'll wait and see there, but yeah, it's a really interesting. I even read somewhere, Chris, someone was trying to get you to put your hat into the ring for that job as well. But you don't fancy moving to Switzerland, no?
I would love to move to Switzerland, but I'm grossly underqualified for that job. I have to. I don't know if I'll ever be qualified for that job, but I would love to move to Switzerland. You know, I'm retired. I can move anywhere.
Yeah, as long as Kristen allows, of course. But let's talk about Zwift Games. Let's talk about Zwift and Zwift Games, because we did discuss this briefly last time, so Chris, so you know I didn't really take part in the Zwift Games. I didn't really see much of it. I watched the first couple of sprints, and then I caught up with the rest later on. But from what I could, it seemed to have like really good engagement with the community. So, you know, have you got some numbers maybe on what the engagement was?
Yeah, I have a lot of numbers. I did my homework, Si.
No, you're not for the numbers.
Well, I want to be able to say something that's factual and actually makes sense. And if as long as they're accurate, I can't really screw that up. All right. So as far as the viewer numbers go, and we're talking about for the actual lead events, I'm going to tell you what they were for the Zwift Grand Prix races 1 and 2. And, you know, we were a bit, you know, critical about, you know, the way those broadcasts were, and then, you know, perhaps about the format for the Zwift Grand Prix, right?
Yeah, but they progressed from what I saw. They progressed and moved on. So hopefully you're going to tell me now the numbers progressed as well.
Well, for the Zwift Grand Prix, the numbers were a downward trend. They started off at about 17,500. That was total for the men and the women for race 1 and 17,500 for race 2.
Okay.
The Zwift Games blew that out of the water. The sprint race was 45,000 viewers total. The epic race was 50,000 viewers total.
Wow.
The climb was another 43,000. So not only were they higher, but they were sustained. You know, sometimes, you know, with a couple of them, the women were higher than the men higher than the women, but it averaged out. So they were, you know, within, you know, with basically within 5,000 views of each other, which is, you know, that's huge, right? So then you tell me why.
Well, I don't want to say we influence this, but we have been banging the drum, Chris, about making the athletes part of the production process, part of the broadcast, but also bringing in more data. We spoke about this with Ollie and Lionel too, you know, because I think you've also rewatched some of the footage from
the CVR Cup, absolutely.
CVR Cups back in 2018 also. And, you know, some of the data we had there was incredible. And, of course, from what I've seen from the Epic race, those sprint races, viewers could access this data platform to give you more data, where the groups were on the road, what was happening with different riders, and so on. So hopefully, you know, I say we're all data nerds there. So hopefully that played a big part of it.
Yeah, I think that, and, you know, the other thing that a lot of the racers, I know James Barnes, when he came on, was really, you know, a firm supporter of this, is that there was a community aspect to it, right? And I know we were just speaking to Flint about, you know, is community really helpful if there's a lack of authenticity in the community? But there's obviously a huge potential there, because that's the one thing that's different, right? The Zwift Grand Prix wasn't necessarily community oriented in the beginning. And this was community oriented, right? So the community is racing the same courses as the elites. You know, is there a connection there, right? Could that put, you know, the broadcast was infinitely better, much more engaging. There was better in so many ways. But I think that has a lot to do with it also.
Yeah, no, you're right. Now I think about that. It's, again, that's something else that we've said before, that lack of pathway, you know, for want of a better word, from even ZRL through to what was the Premier Division or the, you know, the Zwift Grand Prix as it now is, I think, been a bit of an issue. You know, so the fact that, I say the community could take part in all of those events certainly must have helped with that. So I'm guessing they must have had great, you know, engagement also with those events, with the community taking part.
Yeah, so when the announcement came out, it was basically said to be the most democratic, and it's going to be the biggest cycling esports event in the history of cycling esports.
Yeah, I remember that headline, yeah.
Yeah, so I received that email from Zwift today basically saying that they eclipsed their expectation. 80,000 unique participants, 215,000 total races. 50 of the races had over 1,000 starters, which that's a pretty big race field.
It's incredible, yeah.
250 racers per race. And they're going to bring it back next year. They're going to make it an annual event. So yeah, you know, those are pretty big numbers. So it's obvious that the potential is there.
Yeah, no, I mean that eclipses ZRL, I think, in terms of the community engagement. So clearly something did right there. Just coming back to the elite stuff, though. Of course, we did see a bit of a drop off with some of the key names and the key riders within that final event there. For whatever reason, maybe they just didn't fancy racing up the Alp for nothing. So I think they need to look at that structure, but hopefully Zwift do look at the racing structure, they look at the prize money structure also, because I think maybe, you know, it could have been maybe spread further down the field to keep those elites more engaged for that final event as well. Maybe we could just change the order of those races. But again, if this is a flagship event with elites, I would also, coming back to what we spoke about before, I'd still like to see smaller groups within those final races. I know that final sprint was 10 riders, but even the epic for me was nullified until that final, you know, 90 second to 2 minute climb up there, up the Zwiftcom there. So hopefully they look at that, but great numbers, great engagement there. So yeah, hopefully, well, that's absolutely going to continue. The other thing that they did, Chris, obviously this big spin thing they've been doing on recently, but also the April Fools thing. I'd even seen one of the popular YouTubers out there mention this in his YouTube video, that they did some kind of VR headset as a bit of a... Was this a teaser, Chris? Because I also remember a YouTube cycling technical guy doing a... If I remember... No, I did see DC Rainmaker doing a video of the Zwift on VR glasses. So was that a teaser for something to come, do you think?
It's just so funny because I didn't ride on Monday, but my wife rode, and you know, don't tell anybody, but she uses my account sometimes. She doesn't ride a lot, right?
I'm gonna ride in the forum immediately.
She's like, Chris, how come you wear those silly goggles on your avatar? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. But then I realized what she was talking about. Those are VR goggles, and I don't necessarily think that this is actually this isn't a mistake. I think this is a teaser for something going forward. Heard through the grapevine that Zwift is planning to announce another piece of hardware, but they described as disruptive. And I remember, I didn't see anything from DC Rainmaker, but there was a bike radar feature maybe a month or two ago written by Simon von Bromley, and the title was, "With Zwift planning to test Apple Vision Pro, what does the new augmented reality headset mean for the future of cycling?" I think there are too many hints towards the fact that we're going to be offered VR headsets for cycling.
Okay.
And the only thing that I can think of in my mind is that you're going to see me lying next to my trainer in like a pool of vomit, right? Just like crumpled up into a ball, still clipped in.
I'm thinking Kristen may borrow your bike and your account, but she's certainly not going to borrow a sweaty headset from you, right?
Oh, no, she's very careful about staying away from me. But this is potentially could be very interesting. And when you want to talk about disruptive, I think that this could certainly be disruptive.
Yeah, absolutely. I've marked the date and I've marked the time, Chris, that you've made that look into the future. So maybe that is the future and going to happen. So we'll mark that down and we can say you said it first, if that is a reality or virtual reality, should we say?
Well, I think Simon von Bromley said it first.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I was trying to be a bit more succinct there because I've been pretty unsuccinct throughout this whole podcast. But thank you for everybody to listening to episode 40. We've got another great show coming up soon, episode 41, Chris. And we're going to have Aaron Borrell on the show because we are going to talk about the infamous list, of course, the most impactful people in virtual cycling, or cycling esports, should I say. So that show is coming up very soon. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the previous show, show 39, go back and listen to that. That was with Ollie Jones and Lionel Vuillasan. I was trying to just merge the two there. We're, of course, racing over on my Sunday Race Club week in, week out. So also go and check that out. Thanks for joining us for the show, and we'll see you soon for another Virtual Velo podcast.